Hey, man, how's it going, y'all? Welcome to the show. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Coming up on the show today, Stephen Zunis is going to be on. I like Stephen Zunis. Ted Snyder, our friend Ted Snyder, writer for antiwar.com, he wrote this recent piece, and in this recent piece he talks about his talks with Stephen Zunis. And quotes Zunis explaining about the semi-recent history of the diplomatic relationship between Israel and Syria. And what it all means, and why it is the way it is now. And I think it's very interesting stuff. So I thought, you know what I'll do? I'll ask Stephen Zunis if he can do my show. And you know what he said? Yeah, sure. So how do you like that? That's coming on later today. Also, I have a couple of more invites out. I think, you know, maybe I'll hear back from the people I invited. There's a distinct possibility I will hear back from other people I've invited on the show. And then that leaves open the possibility that then possibly they will do the show. But it's all right if they don't, because, hey, you know me. I can go on and on. This show's only 2 hours long. I could do a 24-hour long show, as you know. All right. So, before I get to the debate here, did you see the debate last night? I hope for your sake you didn't, but, you know, for your health. I'll talk about that in a second. But the first thing is, I just wanted to joke about how last night Jeff Tucker and I did our bi-weekly show. Wait, is it bi-weekly? Would that mean twice a week, or does that mean every other week? I really suck at grammar and stuff. Anyway, point is, every other week, Tucker and I do a show called Eye on the Empire for Liberty.me. And last night, the whole first 20 minutes of it was about global warming and the new Paris Agreement and Jeff Tucker explaining what it does and how it is and why it's wrong and how religious liberals and progressives and leftists are on this issue. That was the whole first thing of it. And then the whole second part was me talking about Star Wars and the Republic versus the Empire and this kind of thing, which, you know, I don't know, maybe if you tuned into just that part, you wouldn't be able to tell one way or the other. I don't know. I mean, I asked him at the beginning. I says to him, Jeff Tucker, introduce yourself. He says, I'm Jeff Tucker. I'm from the Foundation for Economic Education. Anyway, then we get to the Trump part. And Tucker and I don't like Trump. So the first comment on the YouTube of the thing is, you two commie leftists are going to be, or he doesn't say commies, but you two leftists are going to be put in the internment camps when Donald Trump comes. And I thought, you know what? That might be right. And if that ever does happen, it'll probably be because of pathetically stupid, wrong information like, you two are a couple of leftists. Even in the face of Jeff Tucker doing a 20-minute long segment on how wrong left-wingers are about the climate. Anyway, I just thought it was funny because it just goes to show how people believe whatever they want. You know, I put out a tweet last night because the whole first part of the debate was, oh, fear, terror, afraid, safety. I will keep you safe. We will protect you from the terror, the fear, scare, fear. The whole thing, it was completely ridiculous. It was like the Daily Show, the old Daily Show, making fun of it, you know? And so I put out a tweet saying, no, fear, safety, terror, government, we love you, government, protect us, government, we're terrified. Conservatives, you know? And I got at least a few tweets back going, oh yeah, well you're on welfare. Oh yeah, well you're a liberal. Oh yeah, you're a Democrat and you love government and you're the one who loves government more than me. That's all they can say. They can't deny that governments are the most fearful and, I mean, conservatives, when I say governments, same thing. Conservatives are the most fearful fear-mongers. They can't deny that the whole first half of the, or more of the damn debate, the whole damn debate, was about what danger we're all in, except for the bravery of our wonderful politicians and their servants. They can't deny that they are basically just right-wing communists. That's all they are. They love government as much or more as a Maoist loves government. They just don't like Maoists because they somehow identify culturally as different. But they certainly love government more than they love Jesus that they claim to believe in. They love government more than they love humanity. They love government more than they love their own families. And they can't deny that. All they can do is try to pretend that I'm some kind of liberal or progressive. Oh yeah, well you're on welfare. Actually, you know what? I decided I would rather go without health insurance at all than take Medicaid or Obamacare or continuing to pay the fascists $8,000 a year for basically worthless coverage. So, yeah, what a commie I'm on when I make $25,000 a year doing this show and accept no subsidy whatsoever, except that I drive on the communist, conservative, American government-owned roads. So, seriously, conservatives, you're horrible. You're absolutely... you're laughable is what you are, you conservatives. Oh, Chris Christie, protect me. Oh, I peed my pants again. I have to go change my pants again. Wah, cries the entire American right, hiding behind Chris Christie's skirt. Oh, the terror, the fear, the scary Arab man. He's coming to get me. Please keep me safe, government. I love you, government. I love you, cry the conservatives. You make the, you know, tree-hugging left-wing Greenpeace types look like, you know, macho bodybuilder ultimate fighting championship dudes. You got John Edwards looking like Hulk Hogan. Is John Edwards still a guy? I guess he's not a guy anymore, but you know what I mean. Pick your favorite pansy liberal Democrat. How about Barack Obama? I mean, I see liberals excuse Barack Obama's mass murder all day. And I guess, you know, it depends. If it's a white guy does a crime, then they start screaming and crying. But when it comes to the Muslims, or, you know, so-called radical Islamic terrorism, which you have to call it that, I don't see them screaming and crying and begging, Obama, I'm so afraid. Oh, Obama, keep me safe. The way conservatives do. It's really childish and pathetic and hilarious. You know, and Rand actually pitched a pretty good case last night. I'll talk about that more in the next segment. But one thing he didn't do, which I think would be very productive, would be to ridicule this entire conservative frame of reference. The same way his father did with the heroin thing. How many people here are all going to become junkies if they legalized heroin? You going to go do heroin now? You need the government nanny state to prevent you from doing heroin? And the whole audience said, wow, he's right. That made perfect sense to me for a moment. They forgot it again, but still. That's what Rand could do. Hey, we're conservatives. We carry guns. We're not afraid of some terrorists. We're Americans. I say abolish the TSA and reinstate the Second Amendment. I dare you to hijack my airplane. We don't need government. We need freedom. We don't need fear. We need to be brave. Not like Chris Christie and Jeb and Trump want you to be.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Eric Schuller is going to be on the show. He's a new writer to me, anyway. Writes some really great stuff. His blog is called The Daily Facepalm. Can you dig it? Yeah, I think so. And he's written a couple of good ones for antiwar.com. I think at least two. And, I like the way the guy thinks, and I hadn't read the whole piece, but I saw you had a decent little write-up about last night's debate. I thought maybe that'd be better than just, you know, me talking about it. Have someone to talk about it with. So that's cool. Looking forward to that. And, I still have one more invite out too that we'll see what happens with that. Anyway. Man, I gotta talk about Star Wars for a second. I heard it was good. That's all. I don't have any spoilers for you. Just, the wife says that according to, you know, the non-spoiler tweets that are coming out and whatever, reaction or whatever from the premiere. Everybody really liked it. Apparently everybody really liked it. Rank it right up there with Empire and something like that. In there between the first two or something, they say, somewhere around there. So I don't know, man. It's a lot of hype. I'm trying not to get my expectations up too high because Star Wars, you know, it's very important to me. And I think at this point I'm ready to just pretend that the prequels never happened. Or that it was, you know, just some cartoon series that's sort of peripheral and isn't really that relevant. I rather my own childhood imagination of before the dark times. But anyway, so whatever. I guess if I don't like 7, then I'll just say, well, whatever. The story ends with Jedi, and that's fine. But I don't know, man. I guess I think that J.J. Abrams is capable. And he co-wrote the thing with Lawrence Kasdan that wrote Empire. And, you know, I don't know. I think that's what Lucas needed. Lucas needed to have, he should have brought on Kasdan and said, man, you helped make Empire great. And so, here, dude, Rick McCallum, you're fired. Kasdan, you're the executive producer now. And let's do these prequels. Cool. And, something. So I don't know, man. I gotta believe it, so I won't fail. That's the deal. Should be fun. Question is, how early do I gotta get there tomorrow? I gotta cancel tomorrow's show to get in line good enough to get good seats. I need good seats. Not bad seats. So, we'll see. But yeah, man, I'm looking forward to it. Guess that means no FFF show tomorrow night. Sorry about that, everybody. Fitz in the, Rotten Tomatoes. Fitz says, Rotten Tomatoes gives it 97%. Resurrected the franchise. Holy, 97, huh? That's good. And then, yeah, he sold Lucasfilm is what he sold. So it's still called that is the answer to your question there. Sold the whole thing. Or maybe he didn't. Maybe he sold just the Star Wars part of it, but it's still called that. Maybe that was part of the deal. I don't know. Cool. Wow. Oh, and, Bolda says his daughter got them reserved seats in the middle of the IMAX. Now see, for me, I can't do the IMAX. I gotta do the plain old because, the wife, her visual cortex can't take that much input, basically. So we got to go see the regular. And I got tickets for Friday night, too. For Thursday and Friday, we're going to go see it on the regular screen. And then I guess
Saturday afternoon or something. I'm going to try to go watch it on IMAX in 3D by myself or with a friend or something, you know. But that's all right. I'll be perfectly happy to watch it in regular 2D on the regular screen as long as it's loud as hell, you know. There you go. But yeah, man, you know, I'm mad at Lucas, too, for acting like such a big bitch about everybody liking the new movie better than his prequels and all that. And he's the one who sold it for $4 billion. He's the one who told Gary Kurtz, fine, beat it. He's the one who had Rick McCallum be the only person who could tell him, I don't think so, George. And that was a huge error, and he's got to own it, man. He's got to own it. And, but at the same time, I gotta give the guy credit that I am who I am because of him. No question about it. As Star Wars and Empire and Jedi when I was a boy, because I was born in 76. I was one when the first one came out. My first one was Empire when I was 3. But it consumed my entire childhood till I was 11 years old. And that's it. As soon as I turned 11, I quit the toys and got a skateboard and a girlfriend, I thought. So anyway, that's different. But no, my entire childhood is Star Wars. More so than any of y'all. I mean, to such ridiculous degrees. My 3 through 11. Those ages. Yeah, you know what? I diverted into Transformers a little bit for a little while and a little bit of G.I. Joe just because their elbows moved and stuff. But, nah, yeah, pretty much not. Star Wars all the time. And yeah, it's a huge part of who I am. Politically as well. That's how I learned what a Senate was in the first place, was I found out that the Emperor had dissolved the Senate permanently. Now we have a Death Star and we'll kill anyone who doesn't go along. So we don't need the pretension of the people's will through their representatives here anymore. And so that's how I first learned about political power, is how arbitrary it is. How it flows from the barrel of a gun, not from the rule of law. And anyway, I'm sure a lot of you guys are a lot like that as well. So anyway, I guess that cancels out. That has to cancel out everything. Any grudge against Lucas for the prequels or for the way he's acting about this one. Being a boohoo little Jeb Bush crybaby about it. But still, I like me. And a big part of who I am is based on what I learned from that guy. So what the hell am I going to do? And you know what's funny too, though, is that, never mind. Star Wars. It's going to be fun. Haha. Tucker just emailed me that comment. Trump will put these leftist nitwits in an internment camp. I swear to God, he spent the whole first 20 minutes talking about how stupid this whole climate change thing is. And how liberals believe it like a religion. And their computer models are nonsense. And whatever. Like, he might as well have been as right-wing as possible. He could have been saying the exact same thing. But anyway, no cognitive dissonance ever stopped a Trump believer from believing whatever they wanted, that's for sure. All right, now, I just blabbed for the last 10 minutes and basically wasted that segment, but I don't care. I like Star Wars. And later on, we're going to have Eric Schuller on the show to talk about the debate with us anyway. I will be giving a little bit of credit to Rand Paul, if you will stay tuned. Up next, our friend Steven Zunis. Hey, that was a coincidence, that bumper music there.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I like this song. Anyways, hey, check it out. First up on our show today is our friend Steven Zunis. And, boy, I just realized I don't have your bio in front of me, but you're a professor at which university there in the Bay Area, Steven?
University of San Francisco.
University of San Francisco. I was going to say that, but then I thought, that doesn't sound right.
Yeah,
but
there are a couple other schools in the area with similar names.
There you go. All right. And, of course, you've got a huge archive at antiwar.com and a lot of other places where you write. You have a couple of new ones here, one at the Huffington Post about the rise of the Islamic State, and another one at truthout.org, what we can expect from Hillary Clinton on Israel-Palestine. Oh, God. I'm putting off reading this one until another, 10 minutes from now. Listen, but first of all, though, I want to talk with you about this Ted Snyder piece that we ran on antiwar.com and also ran at consortiumnews.com. And he goes into the history of the Olmert government in Israel and their attempts to negotiate with the Syrians for a permanent peace, I guess, along the lines of the Camp David Accord with Egypt, that kind of thing. And it's a very interesting history that he goes into there, with a lot of different facets to it. And then, but the reason it's so important is because it seems to me, in the scheme of things, that this process that you describe was a very significant pause in what had been the long-term Netanyahu plan from his leftover from his first prime ministership, which was regime change all around, and most especially in Syria, in order to undermine Hezbollah and Lebanon and all that clean break kind of stuff, coping with crumbling states and all of that. And so here was this attempt by the Olmert government, apparently, to try to come to a better solution, which, not that his government was all that smart when it came to invading Lebanon or anything like that, but anyway, now we're back to the regime change policy, and this was made very stark in the debate last night when Ted Cruz said, hey, I'm for bombing ISIS, but not for bombing Assad. I take Israel's position. Noah Pollack, the prominent neoconservative, tweeted out, that is incorrect. Israel's position is get rid of Assad. And he linked to a letter from Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador to the United States at the time, that he wrote to the Wall Street Journal correcting the record and saying, again, I protest at you saying Israel is concerned about instability. We want Assad gone. And of course, he told the same thing to the Jerusalem Post, and he told the same thing on video to Jeffrey Goldberg at the Aspen Fancy Pants thing in 2004 there, which everybody can find on YouTube. So just further footnotes and confirmation, and it just came up last night. So I was hoping that you could kind of fill in that detail. And it goes to show how unnecessary regime change is if the entire Israeli establishment, after all, just a few years ago, was willing to shake hands with Assad.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and things have evolved, actually. Syria's had a reputation of being one of Israel's most hardline opponents. But starting in the late 80s, early 90s, the Assad regime decided that, they're not going to be able to defeat Israel. The Soviet Union was no longer supporting them. Maybe they should make some kind of deal. And started to make peace overtures. And it became official in the late 1990s, and they went into negotiations, and they basically agreed to, the whole 242 formula, land for peace, that if Israel gave back the southwestern corner of Syria, in the Golan province to Syria, they would recognize Israel, have normal diplomatic economic relations, they would demilitarize the Golan, allow UN peacekeeping forces, et cetera, et cetera. Again, pretty much everything that Israel had supposedly wanted. And you know, there are some they are negotiating, came very, very close, literally within a few hundred yards close, because there is a dispute going back to an old colonial border about whether it was on the shores of Lake Tiberias, also known as the Sea of Galilee, or if it was a couple hundred yards inland, which would sort of give Israel the all sides of the lake. And so things broke off, but it seemed that they were damn close. So people figured, the next round they'll probably find out some kind of compromise around this or whatever. Well, Assad died, and his son took over, and that took a while to sort of stabilize things. And then Sharon came to power, more right-wing government, and they weren't interested in doing this.
Sorry to interrupt, but just stop for a second. The negotiations that you're speaking about now, was that in the first Netanyahu term, or that was after him?
No, this is later. This is under Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who was a more centrist politician.
Right, Netanyahu was in from 96 to what, 98?
And then to the very beginning of 2001.
And then came no, because there was Sharon.
Then Sharon took over.
I'm sorry, I missed one, but I'm just confusing the issue. Yep. Go ahead.
But anyway, there was another attempt back in 2007 when Israel had a coalition government between some center right parties, and the younger Assad made a peace overture, very similar terms. Hey, we want to negotiate. We're ready for peace, etc. And this is the incredible thing. This has been underreported. I wrote about it several years ago, soon after it happened. Obama actually made a veiled reference to it during his 2008 presidential campaign and his speech before AIPAC. But basically, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice called, talked to the Israeli leadership and said, "Don't even think about it. Don't make peace with Assad." And Shimon Peres, the Israeli president, acknowledged that it was U.S. opposition that led the divided cabinet to vote against resuming negotiations with Assad, saying that the United States is virtually our only friend nowadays, and we don't want to upset them by doing something they don't want, like negotiating with the Syrians. Why did the United States not want them to negotiate with the Syrians? Because if Assad had gotten the Golan back, which is a big issue that Syrians across the ideological and sectarian and whatever spectrum, feel strongly about, it would strengthen Assad's rule, and we did not want that. We wanted to undermine Assad's rule. We wanted regime change. In fact, if you go back just a couple years earlier, the United States passed what became known as the Syrian Accountability Act, which was ostensibly to try to force Syria to withdraw its troops from Lebanon. A lot of people refer to it as an occupation. Technically speaking, it wasn't. It was more like the relationship with the Soviet Union and their Eastern European satellites during the Cold War, in that these were nominally independent governments, but the Soviets could basically, tell them more or less what to do on foreign policy and make sure they didn't, go too far away from Soviet interests. But it was something, whatever you want to call it, and most Lebanese didn't like it, and it was quite reasonable to want Syria to leave. What was interesting about this, however, was it was the United States that initially encouraged Syria to invade back in 1976 to try to prevent the leftist Lebanese national movement from taking over, and then supported them again in a December 1990 coup against a prime minister, General Aoun, who had himself staged a coup a few months later, and we were concerned he was very closely allied to Saddam Hussein, whom we were about to go to war with over the occupation of Kuwait. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the United States changed sides and decided they really wanted Syria out of there. And then came the
Hariri assassination in 2005, I guess, right? Yeah. But now, yeah. I'm sorry, because the drum's kicking, which means we got to take this break.
I'll continue the story. It's an interesting one.
Yeah. So it's very complicated, very interesting stuff. Stephen Zunis on Syria, Israel, Lebanon, Hezbollah, and the USA, of course. Right back.
Hey, all Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver commodity discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday. And The Future of Freedom with FFF Founder and President Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. We're talking in a little bit about the history of Israel's interest in peace and war with Syria. Of course, they've been providing medical treatment to Al-Qaeda fighters there for years now, and still at this stage. I'm a bit confused about this whole thing, although maybe the answer's pretty simple. Oh, did I say we're talking with Stephen Zunis about all of this? Stephen, at the point where the Israelis say, okay, we want to go ahead and maybe negotiate over the Golan, and the Americans say, hell no. Well, what the hell is the Americans' interest in this other than doing whatever the hell the Israelis say? The American interest in... It's been the clean break of the neocons all along. Is it just because the neocons are even further to the right than the Israeli government? They're not.
In many respects, that's true. It depends on the Israeli government. Certainly the Israeli government at that time, we were talking about before the break, which was in the... around 2007, that center-right government there, was quite was willing to negotiate, but pressure from the United States led them to do otherwise. Because again, our priority, was to undermine the Syrian regime. And just going back to 2004,
that's what I'm getting at is our policy of undermining the Syrian regime is. Because that's what Israel wants in the first place all along, right?
No, I would say, obviously there's a conjunction of interest there, but the United States, first and foremost, is opposed to any government that challenges U.S. hegemony, and Israel can be an ally in that struggle. This particular example is one of tail wagging the dog. In fact, we get to give another idea. This happened under the Clinton administration. In the late 1990s, public opinion polls showed that something like 75% or more of Israelis wanted to withdraw Israeli occupation troops from southern Lebanon. Despite all the complaints in the United States about the so-called Syrian occupation, the Israelis had been occupying southern Syria for over 20 years. By that point, defying no less than 10 UN Security Council resolutions demanding they withdraw. And this is what gave rise to Hezbollah. There was no Hezbollah before the Israeli occupation. Mm-hmm. They were organized in large part to resist the Israeli occupation. And Israelis are getting tired of their young men getting killed there. In fact, over 300 Israelis have been killed in the occupation. And parents were, and others saying, bring our kids home. But Clinton had his ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk, go on national Israeli television and say that no, Israel should not unilaterally withdraw from Syria. So here we had our ambassador to a foreign country saying that country should continue to defy UN Security Council resolutions and continue this occupation that the vast majority of the people in that country did not want, not to mention, of course, the Lebanese, who had been suffering like crazy with thousands of people killed as a result of it. But eventually, the Israelis had enough. They withdrew in kind of a hectic fashion in 2000. But the reason we wanted Israel to stay there was we wanted to pressure the Lebanese government to distance themselves from Syria. Again, we did not want Syrian political domination there. And again, we didn't want the Syrian government to exist at all. It was one of the last bastions of the secular Arab nationalism one that opposed both Islamist extremism, but also opposed Western imperialism. We had a number of victories in the eyes of the United States. You know, when Sadat switched sides after the death of Nasser and moved Israel, you know, from a anti-imperialist to a pro-Western position. And in more recent years, of course, we've seen how Saddam and Gaddafi were overthrown. Assad was sort of the last bastion of this kind of tradition, and we wanted to get rid of him. And this is, and again, this is we've had a hard time with these nationalist anti-West governments, and whether it be in Latin America or Southeast Asia or Africa or whatever.
The Netanyahu's government is certainly interested in regime change in
Syria. Very, very much so. In fact, well, but it's kind of interesting, though. Let's go up to a 2000. So anyway, this Syria Accountability Act in 2004 mentioned, threatened serious sanctions against Syria if they didn't withdraw from Lebanon. Okay, that's reasonable. I think they should have withdrawn before as well. But it was so hypocritical because they cited the very United Nations Security Council resolutions that called on Israel to withdraw, as saying, what, the UN says no foreign forces should remain in Lebanon. And Israel is the only country mentioned by name in that resolution. Yes, it applied to Syria, too. But, you know, the hypocrisy was just incredible. It's not once that Congress complained about Israel violating it during their 22-year occupation. Right. But all of a sudden, this UN, these UN Security Council resolutions became sacrosanct because it involves Syria. And they added all these riders to this thing, saying that even if Syria did withdraw from Lebanon, we have to impose these heavy-duty sanctions less than until they dismantle their medium-range missiles. Even though Turkey, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Syria had very similar missiles or even better missiles, but we said no, Syria had to get rid of them unilaterally. Same with their chemical weapons. Now, Israel didn't have to get rid of theirs. Egypt didn't have to get rid of theirs, but Syria did. They cited that joker's name. One of the guys who really grossly exaggerated the weapons of mass destruction myth around Iraq. You know, they cited him. You know, even though he'd been totally discredited, what events had happened the year before. I mean, it was filled with all sorts of things, including threat, blaming Iraq. Are blaming Syria for the deaths of American servicemen, even though most of the Americans are being killed by these hardcore Sunni groups, the very ones that are fighting the Assad regime now.
That we're backing against them now,
in regime change. Okay, let's move it forward to a couple years later to 2006, when the United States, working with Israel.
Well, wait, what about 2005 when Hariri was assassinated? I'm with Porter that it must have been al-Qaeda that did it, but they blamed it on Hezbollah, and therefore Syria, which backs Hezbollah, demanded that the Syrian army had to get out of Lebanon, which, of course, just empowered Hezbollah, filled the power vacuum that the Syrian army had been filling at that point.
It was a popular, it was a genuine popular uprising that got rid of the Syrians, but of course, the U.S. used this to try to blame Syria for it. But in 2006, we actually, the Bush administration pushed Israel to attack Lebanon to try to wipe out Hezbollah and attack Syria as well. Well, the Israelis said, no, that's too much. We can't take on both of them. So in a summit in Washington in May 23rd between Olmert and Bush, Bush said, Olmert agreed that they would attack Lebanon that August. Well, in July, Hezbollah did this provocative border incident where they kidnapped two Israeli soldiers and whatever, and that was the excuse for Israel's invasion. But that had been planned for many, many months, with the U.S. pushing it. In fact, there are a lot of Israelis in the top military leadership who said, this isn't a very good idea. And in fact, the fact that the United States had pushed it, what became an issue within Israel. You had 30,000 Israelis protesting in Tel Aviv, chanting, "We will not fight and die for Bush. We will not fight and die for Bush." Again, they saw this correctly as something that the United States had really pushed on Israel, because since Israel had withdrawn from Lebanon in 2000, not a single Hezbollah rocket had landed in Israel. Not a single Israeli civilian had been killed. But thanks to this Israeli attack, scores of Israeli civilians got killed, along with about 700 Lebanese civilians from the Israeli bombing. But again, this is something that the Bush administration pushed on Israel to do. Why do we want to destroy Hezbollah at that point? Because Hezbollah, again, had not been attacking Israel. They had largely demobilized. They were working more as a Lebanese political party. I mean, admittedly a pretty reactionary one, but they were working within the system, and they But the concern was they were getting all these new missiles from Iran. Why were they getting missiles from Iran when they weren't actually fighting anybody at that point? Because they knew that at that point the Bush administration was planning a large scale attack on Iran, and they wanted in conjunction with Israel, and that they wanted a retaliatory capability. They wanted this to be a kind of deterrent. So the Bush administration figured, hey. And their allies within the Israeli government said, hey, if we take out these missiles preemptively, destroy Hezbollah, then we can go into Iran. Well, as you know, this the 2006 invasion was a disaster. The Israelis and their own investigative committee, they won a grand commission that was actually chosen by Olmert, was very, very critical of the government and going ahead with this. Mm-hmm. And again, a lot of Israelis blame the United States to this day. But again, the original target, or the original additional target, was Syria. So I'm using this chronology, going out through Bill Clinton, through George W. Bush. There was a very explicit desire for regime change in Syria. And the Israelis supported it too. Though there are some divisions, especially again in the Labor Party and some of the more moderate elements, believing that maybe Syria could be accommodated. We're seeing these divisions even now, because what's happened is that and divisions within Washington, in that the Obama administration, like the moderate Israelis, would obviously like to see Assad go. I think particularly given the large-scale war crimes he's committed. At the same time, ISIS as a very serious threat. The instability, a very serious threat. And there's been all sorts of and frankly, my impression is that you have divisions both within Israel and the Obama administration as to how much priority should be to get rid of Assad, how much priority should get rid of ISIS, what kind of rebels we should support, and both the Israelis and the Americans are kind of beside themselves about this monster they've helped create and how to handle the fallout.
Yeah, well, I don't think I've ever heard anybody really stick up for Assad. It's universally agreed. Here is a fascist murderer dictator. But it's sort of beside the point. The question is, who supports him? The answer is more than half the population of the country, including a huge plurality, at least, of the Sunni population of the country. Because his state, not necessarily they support him, but the state that he is the chief of is what's standing between them and a good crucifixion. And they know it. And America and Israel and Turkey and Saudi have been backing Ahrar al-Sham, which is nothing but al-Qaeda, and in effect al-Nusra, which is nothing but al-Qaeda, and even according to their own documents, in effect, the Islamic State. Even though they knew and predicted the danger that this could really lead to the creation of a place called the Islamic State out of the group by blowing back into Western Iraq. And they did it all on purpose, and even the head of the DIA says so too.
Yeah, it was. It's been.
And I know you got to go too, so I'm sorry. You can wrap this up. We're overtime into the break at this point.
I agree with about most of what you said. I nitpick at a fair number of levels, but on some other points. But I think overall. The problem is that you know, as we've seen when we supported hardline Islamists against the communists in Afghanistan, and we support hardline Islamists and against these nationalist governments, you know, that we end up creating these even bigger threats, and then use that as an excuse for still further intervention. Yeah. And it's just so ironic to see so many people who were so passionately supported the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which was really what created ISIS more than anything, are now saying, "Oh, the problem is we haven't used enough. We need to militarize the situation even more."
Right. Yeah, and of course, I don't want anybody to get me wrong. Like, I'm for backing dictators or, renditioning torture victims to Assad or any of this opposite policy either. I'm just talking about trying to highlight the insanity of taking bin Laden's side. As soon as they dump him in the ocean, they take the side of all of his men in Libya and Syria. It's unbelievable, but true. Anyway, I know I got to let you go. Thank you very much for your time again on the show, Stephen. Great to talk to you. Appreciate it. All right, that was Stephen Zunis, and we'll be right back after this.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, all, Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Me. Welcome back to the show, guys. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. By the way, if you're not too familiar, I hope you understand. Zunis, he isn't spinning for Israel there. He's just indicting America more in a certain context, that's all. If you read what he writes, he's been very good on Palestinian issues, I assume, his entire career, so... Don't anyone get that confused, what he was saying. He's just getting down into the weeds about exactly what happened. Wasn't trying to... Because that's the... I know. People always assume anytime you ever hear information you ain't like, or you didn't think before, whatever, immediately you go to the motive of the person doing the telling. And you should! Because people are trying to lie to you all the time. But so I'm just letting you know that I think if you go back and you look at what the dude says, he's a straight shooter, man. That's all I'm saying. I wouldn't want anybody to get that confused. All right, now I guess I kind of don't want to say too much. Maybe I should say everything I got to say now so that then I'll shut up and let Eric Schuller have his say when it's time to interview Eric Schuller about what he thinks about the debate. Right? That's probably a good idea. It won't be quite the Lou and Tom show because I don't really know this guy other than through email, but I like him. Or wait, did I interview him one time already? Wonder if my brain knows. I think my brain thinks maybe I did. Anyway. So, man, did you see the debate last night? So it was horrible. I hope you're living your life instead of watching the horrible freaking crazy thing. But Jeb Cruz and Trump all came out in explicitly in favor of war crimes. Explicitly in favor of war crimes. Ted Cruz was asked about carpet bombing. He wasn't asked about nuking, which he did say, yeah, we'll see what they look like when they're glowing in the dark, which is a reference to fission, if not fusion. And but they skipped that, but they said, so what about carpet bombing? And he says, oh, I don't mean carpet bomb the cities. I just mean carpet bomb ISIS where they are. And then he even says something about, like, you know, like troop divisions out in the field. Yeah, because that's what the Islamic State does. They take all of their guys and then they mass them in the field like Southerners in the Civil War to get slaughtered. Like George Washington's men fighting the British. Go ahead and kill all of us. We'll just stand here in the field and wait for you to completely mow us down. Thanks. Because they're idiots. Okay, no. That's not how they fight. Actually, they're a militia movement. They don't have a regular army. They're just trying to become one. And as soon as the airstrike started, they all went and melted in with the civilian population. Carpet bombing means carpet bombing. That's what he said. And he still stood by it. Kinda, sorta. Anyway. Then Trump was asked by a grad student who, for whatever rules, was allowed to ask a question. And he says, man, you came out and you said, go after their families? If somebody does a terrorist act that their innocent family members should be punished, isn't that illegal? Isn't that a war crime and that kind of thing? And he doubled down on it. Said, oh yeah. And take, for example, the San Bernardino shooters. And then he just pretends to know that everybody that they know knew that they were going to do something and didn't stop them. So they're all guilty too. And look at all the family and friends and associates of all the 9/11 hijackers. They all left the country. She could have made a bigger deal about that part. They were all flown out of the country so they could go home and watch their boyfriends on TV and their great things. Something like that. And so, yeah. And then he said, you know, and people care about their families. They don't care about themselves. Maybe they'll care about their families. And it'll be a real disincentive for them to do, you know, terrorist acts. This is unbelievable. And it's one of Rand's good points of the night where he said, hey, I want to get to the question of Trump's, you know, suitability for the office here. When he says that, he's talking about America would have to repudiate the Geneva Conventions to do that. All right? When he's talking about closing down the internet, he's talking about repealing the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And so he's talking about making America not America anymore in order to what? To kill innocent family members who may or may not be assumed to be guilty of their kin's crimes? What? And then Jeb Bush, too. Oh, yeah. You know, a big problem with the war now is the lawyers, you know, those pencil-necked geeks, dictating to the military who they can and cannot kill. And he said this in the context of saying, oh my God, Donald Trump is the worst, most un-American person ever for saying keep the Muslims out. Because that makes us look mean and we need to partner with the moderate Muslims. And cultivate nice attitudes. We need to domesticate them. Co-opt their leaders. You know, this is his version of make nice with them. While he's talking about re-legalizing his brother's war crimes. Maybe reinstating the memos that the Bush administration itself and the lawyers at the end finally repudiated. That pretended to construct legality for purely criminal behavior. Like torturing people to death. For example. Like 10 million billion counts of violations of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. And on and on. So, there you go. Outright war crimes in the thing. And at one point, Chris Christie, was talking about absolutely shooting down Russian planes over Syria. The whole conversation, not the whole conversation, but pretty much devoid of, you know, the context involved. Why in the world would America shoot down Russian jets? You know, H-bomb armed Russia jets. Because they're bombing Al-Qaeda targets in Syria? And America doesn't like that? Don't bomb Arar al-Sham. Don't bomb al-Nusra. Just bomb ISIS. Or we'll shoot you down and risk a war. Risk a war with a real state. With thermonukes. Because they're bombing al-Qaeda. Really? I mean, it was there. I don't know. I know, you're worn out on the irony of the whole thing. Me too, but then again, I sort of can't help it. Here's a Republican debate for the presidency. For the nomination to run for the presidency of the United States of America. And they're crying about the Russians bombing al-Qaeda. And saying that, yeah, we will get into war with Russia. John Kasich said, yeah, the Russians need a punch in the nose for what they're doing over there. Are these people completely out of their mind? And they're so stupid. They're so crazy. You know, and I actually missed, the wife and I started talking about Star Wars, and I missed a significant part of it where they were talking about Syria. And Rand was pretty damn good on the Syria issue in this one. But the part where I phased back in and started listening again, Kasich was saying, well, yeah, but we can't back down now. Oh, my God. What? And I don't know exactly, but it sure sounded like he was conceding that, yeah, if we get rid of Assad, al-Qaeda or Nusra will take over. That this is who we've been fighting for all along. And he ends with, no, the Saudis have promised us they will construct a moderate new Sunni government for Syria. They are our allies. We have to go with them on that. The Saudis have been backing Nusra, ISIS, al-Sham, terrorists this whole time. Along with Obama.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com.
You hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, guys, welcome back. Coming up, Eric Schuller is going to be on the show to have his say about the Republican debate last night. I think you'll be interested to hear that. If you like Star Wars, please go read Dan Sanchez at antiwar.com. He wrote a great piece. Way better than my half-baked crap from 10 years ago that I wrote when Episode 3 came out. It's really good. It's, just check him out in the right margin there at antiwar.com, Dan Sanchez. Okay, so, I gotta give credit to Rand Paul, but now I still won't give him full credit because he still fell short, and I'll get to that part, but I'll give him the good part of the credit, which is that last night he put on his dad's shoes, I guess, or something, and went out there and kind of fought with him a little bit. Now, in the second debate, they asked Rand Paul, hey man, you said in the past that Republican hawks helped lead to the rise of ISIS. And he gave a canned, provably canned answer that they must have warned him exactly what the question would be. That, no, only ISIS is responsible for ISIS. And at the exact moment he was still saying it, the tweet went out with the exact words, too, right? It was cocked and loaded and ready to hit send on. And, 'cause I was watching. And anyway, so this time she said it to him again, and then he goes, yeah, you know, the regime change hasn't worked. And this kind of gets, anyway. So he talks about Libya, Syria. They asked him about Iraq. He kind of demurred on Iraq. He didn't want to say, yes, Iraq was a terrible thing. He's, meh, you know, it was kind of one of those that didn't also work. And he, and then, but on Syria, he's saying getting rid of Assad is a bad idea, man. And he was pretty good on that. But one thing he didn't deny, and they didn't ask him, and was the biggest and best blown opportunity here, was he should have opposed regime change in Raqqa and Mosul as well. He should have said, not just is it a bad idea to support regime change against these secular dictators, it's a bad idea to back secular dictators. That's part of what turned our friends, Reagan's Mujahideen, against us. And so, let's just not do any of this anymore. No more invasions, no more sock puppet dictators, no more sock puppet jihadi armies, no more foreign aid for anybody. No more making our allies enemies our enemies. No more Dick Cheney-style promises about we'll leave as soon as we're done here. Just call the whole damn thing off. That's the deal. It's like he's deliberately hitting a line drive where he can get to first base, you know, when he could hit a home run right out of the park. And he's choosing instead to just take a base hit. Why? Why not get up there and say, listen, and this is Rand's advantage over Ron if he would use it. Ron is too classy. Ron never calls people names. Ron never even calls people by their names. Ron doesn't say, George Bush and Bill Clinton got us into this mess. George W. Bush and Hillary Clinton in the Obama years doubled and tripled it, see? Because Ron Paul is just too damned polite. He will not point his finger at people, only at policies. Now, Rand made the PR mistake last night that I think, and Ron makes this mistake sometimes too. It's not the royal we, like, oh, I'm so fancy that I'm speaking for you too. We think this and we think that. It's not the royal we, it's the humble we. It's the, you know, I'm not trying to blame you too much, so I associate myself with it, kinda. Ron Paul do this too. We, meaning the government. We do this and we do that, naming bad things, and he's including himself on it. Just from a PR mistake, Scott Adams would say, don't do that. Rand should not be saying, we, as he did, we took these terrorists and resettled them and put them on welfare and in public housing. And then they tried to do this attack, which I don't know the truth of that or whatever. But he shouldn't have said we this and we that. He should have said the Obama government. The Obama administration did that. The Congress's policy that I opposed did that and separate himself from it. That's a minor point. But the real point being that he could have really, and, you know, I think he, clearly it was his best night. He could have done much better, but I hope that he recognizes that the reason it was his best night is because it wasn't full of a bunch of hedging. It was because he finally just told the plain truth. If anything was lacking in there, it's that he's not, you know, kind of cracking wise at their expense. I'm sorry I tweeted that exact phrase. I was trying to think of a better one on the spot there and it didn't work. But anyway, he could really be making hay out of the contradictions in the policies of the people on the stage. Like, look, everybody, I know that you may not all keep up with foreign policy or anything real, you know, very heavily here. But in the Syrian war, there's the secular dictatorship on one side, and there's the jihadists on the other, and everybody else on this stage is on the side of the jihadists against the secular dictatorship. That's protecting the Christians, that's protecting the Druze, that's protecting the Shiites from possible annihilation at the hands of the Islamic State and the al-Nusra Front, were they to eventually be completely victorious in sacking the Damascus government. Read that. These guys, there's a massive sectarian civil war in the region, and every Republican up here is on the side of the jihadists against the Shiites. And then he could just say, I'm not saying take the side of the Shiites, but what the hell are we doing back in Al-Qaeda? And then how do they justify it? And John Kasich, you know, because, again, the whole argument is taking place in a vacuum of no knowledge, right? They can get up there and say, Assad is a bad guy and whatever, and leave unanswered, oh, yeah, well, what's next? And that kind of thing. People don't even notice because there has been virtually no discussion, no real discussion of this in the media at all. Nobody, even the candidates, are really familiar with what the hell's going on there in a lot of ways if you listen to them talk about it. And so Rand, really, to be successful, he needs to tell the story. Here's what happened. And he can personalize it so well. This is all the Bush's and the Clintons' fault. See, Jeb over there, his father occupied the Arabian desert, the holy land of Mecca and Medina. Then Bill Clinton stayed there. And that's what provoked all the terrorist attacks of the 90s and leading up to the September 11th attacks. And then George Bush's son doubled and tripled the damn mistake by invading and occupying the whole Middle East and radicalizing an entire generation. And then Bill Clinton's wife, who was the real president in the first Obama term when it came to foreign policy, she took the side of the jihadists in Libya and Syria. Aided and abetted by Marco Rubio up here.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
Just occurred to me, everybody, I should have got the soundbite of Trump explaining that the power of nuclear devastation is very important to me here. Wasn't that what he said? Something like that. Oh, yes, the devastation of the nuclear destruction. Anyway, lots of fun. Okay, on the line, I got Eric Schuller. Oh, I hope I'm saying your last name right there.
Yeah.
I meant to ask you in the break there. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Did I say it right?
Yep, okay. You got it right.
Well, sometimes I screw people's names. Eric has written a few articles for antiwar.com, and he's got this great blog. I think you'll like his writing and his point of view here. It's called The Daily Facepalm. Quite appropriate for following the news we follow around here. And this one is a Republican debate summary, a win for non-intervention, and you put a question mark on there. So I'll let you go ahead and score the thing however you like.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think one of the things that it's important to keep in mind is, like, you're always going to hear, you know, a lot of the same terrible things in these debates. And so what was unique about this one, though, is that you actually had somebody pushing back. And it wasn't even just Rand Paul. So, you actually had a diversity of opinion, which you just don't get on foreign policy in these debates. And so you had the standard kind of cruise line of call it radical Islam, and, you know, you had Fiorina talking about how great it is to help out the NSA. But, you know, after you got done with that, you had, you know, legitimate debate on whether regime change is a good idea and whether it actually is helpful. And so I think that's kind of the thing I took away from it, is you had all the bad like normal, but for once you actually had somebody saying something intelligent on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, I think a big part of the setup here, it's funny, and I know I got a chip on my shoulder and whatever, but I don't care. I give him credit anyway. But I think Rand is kind of playing catch-up to Trump here. It's like in the second debate when Trump says, hey, Carson, high five, that we were both smarter and knew that the Iraq War was a bad idea back then. And Rand was left going, yeah, but me too. I also was against it. And he had done so such a good job of playing that down that then there he was having to play catch up. Ron Paul's son having to play catch up and say, I also am anti-war. And Trump, it's amazing to me, but Trump has been able to say, oh, yeah, no, if you support the Iraq war, you're stupid, which he doesn't say that about his voters, but he says that about the Bushes and about Hillary Clinton, and they don't mind. The Republican rank and file don't mind. They now apparently are ready to accept that, okay, Iraq War II really was stupid. Not that I'm sorry about all my neighbors I called traitor or anything, but okay, I guess you're right now, as long as it's Trump saying it, and then the rest of them are playing catch-up. And Cruz has decided apparently too that if he points his finger and says Rubio is going to try to get us into trouble we don't need, and I'm more shrewd than that, that's good politics here. Not being the worst warmonger of all, not seeing who can out Giuliani each other up there, but people moving closer and closer to Ron Paul, at least rhetorically.
Yeah. Well, and I thought it was interesting too. Trump got a question at one point that was something to the effect of, you know, would America be safer if dictators were running the Middle East still? And he basically, like he said, you know, we wasted a lot of money and it's not like we had a victory. And, you know, basically said we should have been spending that money at home. Like almost, I mean, he didn't frame it this way, but almost like a reference to the peace dividend concept, which is just not something you expect to hear out of a Republican frontrunner.
Yeah.
And so that was pretty interesting. And I also thought, you know, Rand Paul, his opening statement, you know, because, you know, that's the thing they're preparing. So off the cuff, you know, that's something else. But the opening statement, I mean, he really went hard after Trump on, you know, closing down the internet and even defending the Bill of Rights. I mean, you know, applauding the Bill of Rights and not just the Second Amendment part. Like, that's kind of new, too. And, you know, and that's it almost seems to me like maybe that could signify a shift in kind of his strategy, because that's, you know, that's how he was positioning himself for the debate. And I don't know. That seems to bode well from my perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I hope he noticed that last night was his best night. And I, in fact, I think he did, because I saw that his people put out a tweet that was a compilation of tweets of all different Republican, you know, wags, Laura Ingraham and Steve Deese and some Fox News people. And I don't know the whole list, but it was, you know, conservative thought leaders, if there's such a thing.
Right.
And they liked it. And they thought it was his best performance ever. And they didn't say, boy, I really like how anti-war he was finally. But again, they sure didn't seem to mind it.
Exactly. Well, and you know, and of course, he's not really staking out the, you know, the full-on non-interventionist position. I mean, he still, you know, kind of made a reference to Arab boots on the ground, not U.S. boots on the ground. So it's not, you know, it's not necessarily the position that you or I might take on it. But it's still, compared to, you know, everybody else on the stage, it's just leagues different.
Mm. Well, and that's the thing. He absolutely is in favor of regime change in Raqqa and Mosul, Fallujah, Ramadi. No doubt about that.
Right.
I mean,
but just not Damascus. Which, yeah. I mean, at this point, I think I'm, you know, I'll take what we can get, right?
Yeah. I'm not so sure. I mean, I think that if we encourage the best in him and encourage him to go ahead and abandon all this stupid pandering, that he could make a much better case for just non-intervention at this point. You know what, tough guy? You guys want to send in the whole Marine Corps or some imaginary Saudi army or whoever to sack Mosul? Then what?
Right.
Then what?
Well,
and go ahead and fight with them about it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think he could really, I mean, I disagree with his, you know, his stance on immigration, but since he's trying to take the very, like, intense border security stance, it seems like it's a very, you know, it'd be easy to parlay that into saying, well, you know, we're just going to defend the borders here, so we don't need to be there. And so, like, it seems like he's kind of setting himself up for that if he wants to.
The regime change thing, he can link the two back and forth again. We're supposed to be all concerned about who now? About veterans of the Syrian war that we've been supporting their side this whole time, blowing back against us, just like I told you not to do it. And he did actually say that a couple of times last night. I thought it was funny, actually, where the CNN lady was like, no, go back to the Iraq thing and whatever. She's really trying to push him to answer more. He was kind of taking the changing the subject a little bit to his practiced answer about border security or whatever. And she's like, no, go back to the Syria thing. So I thought that was good, at least, that, you know, they kept that up for a little while. And I actually missed a bit of the Syria discussion because I was talking Star Wars with the wife. But then when I phased back in, Eric, it was the part where Kasich was saying, but we can't back down now. And the Saudis promised that they're going to build a brand new moderate government there. That's what we have to do.
And they're backed by Iran and Russia. So obviously we can't leave. And that was interesting because, you know, Rubio basically took that position. Kasich took that position. You had Cruz, you know, even pushing back on that. And, yeah, he just wants to, you know, basically carpet bomb the parts that are under control of ISIS. But he's, you know, basically staking out a position of not doing regime change in Damascus now. And that's, you know, so you have the two basically leading candidates that are anti-regime change in the Republican Party, you know, Cruz and Trump. So,
see, and that's what's significant here is nobody should think that either of us believe or would have them believe that what these people say is true or anything like that. The point is they're all trying to manipulate you so that you will give them power over you. So what is it that they think that they need to say to win you over? And finally, it seems, at least for now, until the next thing explodes or is shot or whatever, that the crest of the wave has tipped and that conservatives would rather keep the son they have left than send him off to get killed too.
Right. Well, and I think it was also significant that Trump, Cruz, and Paul all actually finally brought up Libya in like a real way and saying, you know, look what came out of this. And that's been something that hasn't come up in a meaningful way in the Democratic debates or in the Republican debates so far. And it is like, you know, that was, and I saw that was like, finally, somebody, you know, somebody's been reading something on antiwar.com or something. I don't know.
Right. But a good question that they didn't ask him was, so what do you do about it now that there are guys flying the black flag of Baghdadi over Tripoli, dude?
Yeah.
And don't give me some pablum about, well, it was, I don't know. We'll make the Algerians do it, or, you know.
Right.
Oh, man, I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean, now the music's playing, we got to take this silly break. Then we'll be back. It's Eric Schuller. Check out his great blog. It's ericscottschuller.blogspot.com, the Daily Facepalm. And you can find a couple of his articles up at antiwar.com as well.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
I miss it. Hey, chat room guys, did they say what they're doing with the interest rate yet? Probably nothing. That's my guess. Yeah. All right. Eric Schuller is on the line, author of The Daily Facepalm. Boy, am I feeling it. I'll tell you what. We're talking about the Republican debate last night. And I'm sorry, I forget at which point I interrupted you for the break here, Eric. You were going to say.
We were talking about... you know, they didn't really ask, like, okay, so what do we do now? And I was going to say, I mean, in some ways, I'm kind of glad they didn't because I'm afraid what anyone would say. But, you know, so the fact that it didn't get emphasized, like, I'm all right with that.
Yeah. You know, that's kind of been my thing about Libya all along is, you know, people complain sometimes and say, yeah, nobody pays any attention to what a disaster Libya is. And I'm saying, you know what? That could be worse. And once they start paying attention to it, then the next step from there is proposed solutions. And I don't think any of us want to hear them if we know what's good for us anyway. All right. Now, so here's the thing that, and you really start your article with this too. Second place or something here is the avowed support for war crimes among Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, Jeb Bush, and Ben Carson. And Carson and Cruz's war crimes were more or less the same. Jeb was not as specific. Trump had his own unique kind of war crimes. And it's just a matter of debate. Just a policy preference, I think, Eric.
Yeah. Well, and Rand Paul, to his credit on that point, you know, he brought back, you know, Trump's plan. Trump doubled down on his plan to, you know, go after the families. And Rand Paul, you know, instead of making like a humanitarian appeal, he said, you know, like, we're going to have to withdraw from, you know, the Geneva Conventions, which probably, you know, most of the base isn't too concerned about. But he also said, like, do you still believe in the Constitution? Which, if you're going to attack, you know, Trump on that issue, framing it in terms of like, the Constitution says this is wrong, is probably the best way you're, you know, best way for him to frame it. So I thought that was, you know, worth noting too. And
he actually kind of referred to the difficulty of the logistics of getting the First Amendment repealed. Like, that could take a long time.
He's like, so are we just going to go away? Yeah, that was an interesting approach. And I also, and maybe I missed this, but I actually thought that, you know, Bush, you know, compared to Trump, he actually seemed to outline a slightly less, you know, awful position on, you know, banning all Muslims and the family piece, because he, you know, he said that this isn't how we, you know, win people over to our side, which, you know, I mean, it's kind of beside the point that that's actually a real debate, but, you know, at least it, pretty much no one would seem to be signing on for Trump's position on that from what I took away for it.
It was amazing the way he doubled down on that and didn't say, well, you know, we would have the cops investigate and figure out whether they know something or not, or, you know, something. But no, he didn't back down whatsoever, just doubled down on that. Really was amazing there, the way he did that.
And of course,
Jeb, in his refutation of Trump on that, in that same answer, said, well, you know, a big part of the problem, they all did this. Anytime they're asked about attacks here, they change the subject to let's attack over there. And he says, big problem is the damn lawyers are hamstringing the people fighting the war against the Islamic State over there. We need to set them free. That was like the first half of the sentence before he pivoted to, and boy, you shouldn't be mean to Muslims. That makes us look bad. We're trying to suck up to these people.
It is a very odd disconnect that, you know, I think, yeah, half the stage is outlining political correctness as really the big problem in our war. It's not the war itself. It's definitely that we're not killing enough civilians.
Yeah. And not just the PR men, but the lawyers. The damn lawyers say that we can only bomb if we don't think we're going to kill some kids. And then, you know, we want to, though. And then that was Carson's thing. And the Hugh Hewitt, hey, Carson, you're a brain surgeon. You're not a politician. You're new at this. Are you really ready to kill a bunch of children? Wow. And he says, yeah.
Yeah. But he did object to, you know, he had enough PR sense in him. Like, I object to the word ruthless, tough and resolute, not ruthless. I mean, yeah, there's people still going to die, but let's frame it a little different. Come on now.
Yeah, it's not the end. It's the means to the end, Hugh.
And Hugh, you know, likened it, ISIS to Hitler, as, like, the same level of threat to make it, you know, sound a little more okay.
Yeah, exactly. Are you going to do like Churchill did, what was necessary to bring down the Third Reich?
Because I think he must have caught himself as, wait, we probably shouldn't say that in nihilist isolation. That's going to be taken out of context pretty easily.
Yeah, well, the whole damn thing's kind of taken out of context.
Go ahead.
No, you please.
I thought it was interesting is Cruz actually, at first I thought it was a gaffe, but I was, you know, rereading kind of the transcript on it. And he actually said twice that Iran has declared war on the United States. Did you catch that?
No, I'd missed that. It was funny, as I watch it and I see the tweets go by, I go, they said that? I just really can't listen to these clowns. I try.
Yeah, no, I mean, you have to tap out and take a break midway through or something. Right. But twice, you know, and I guess it's, you know, part of his line of radical Islam, so you can't distinguish between, you know, different parts of it, even if they're fighting each other. But yeah, he said, you know, ISIS and Iran are at war with the United States. And it's so funny, too, because in a, you know, not in a good way, you know, aha way, but, he, at one point, you know, he's basically saying we shouldn't do regime change against Syria because it'll backfire. But at one point, he just kind of mentions offhand, like, well, you know, regime change in Iran, that's something I could support.
Right.
Like, what? But didn't you just hear your last five sentences?
Yeah. He's saying, enough of this utopian nation building and spreading democracy and all of this. What we need to just do is protect our national interests and fight our enemy, Iran, and their enemy, the Islamic State. Really? All just in one breath like that.
Yeah, you gotta take out both sides of the Civil War to win the Civil War. That's how it goes.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing that I found, kind of interesting is, Christie's not really not a real player at this point, it doesn't seem like. But, Rand actually had a pretty good line on him, too, I think his quote was something like, well, if you're in favor of World War III, I think you found your candidate. And it's like, and just framing the issue starkly and, not trying to mince words, which he seemed to do a lot better than that. I want to see the next debate and hope that they can keep the momentum going of just, people actually talking about this. Because I think at this point, the Republican Party is almost less terrible on foreign policy, at least the leadership, than the Democrats would be, which is, would make for a much more interesting, post-debate. Post-primary, anyway.
Yeah, no, I think the Republican hawks, and particularly the neocons, I try to follow some neocons on Twitter. I actually can't take most of it. I follow Max Boot and a few of these other guys. And, their frustration at the whole Trumpian movement is, really kind of fun to watch, their panic. I mean, it's as bad as mine. I'm not saying I like him, but I just like seeing how upset they are that, the winds are just not with them. The people don't really know who the neocons are, but they know that now that there is such a thing as the neocons, and they're the ones who always are the most pro-war, and I don't think maybe we should be listening to them. And the fact that that is kind of, it's 2015, but hey, that's finally kind of soaking in and getting through to, Republican masses out there. That's pretty powerful and a pretty good. Just the fact that all the front runners continue to sound somewhat a little bit anti-war themes. I assure you, I'm really tough and everything, but I think we should be doing less. And they have focus grouped that enough. They know that that's what people are demanding to hear at this point.
Right.
So.
Well, and it was interesting, too, even when, Trump got a question on the nuclear triad, and he basically didn't answer it. But, I definitely expected, we need a, the standard answer you would expect, which was pretty much given by Rubio, was, we got to double down, we got to modernize, and, it's the greatest deterrent in the world, and ISIS isn't apparently paying attention to it, but, it's still the greatest deterrent in the world against somebody, and, we need to spend as much money as possible to... And that was just not the coined response from everybody. It's just, obviously Trump's no dove, but it's nice that he doesn't have to say horrible things about literally every foreign policy issue.
Well, and I think the triad thing just confused him because he didn't know what the hell that meant.
Right.
And so he's like, well, I don't know. I'm just going to bluster for a few minutes here and hope to get away with it.
Right. But at least he didn't say, nuclear weapons are the, best thing
right.
that's ever happened.
Yeah, and in fact, even his thing where he's like, the power of the nuclear devastation is very important to me. All he was really trying to say was, no, I take that very seriously. Or, he just
was
a kook about it the way it came out. But, that's what he meant, really. Anyway, so listen, man, I really appreciate your little write-up here, and I appreciate your time on the show talking about this today. It's much better than just hearing me talk, that's for sure. We're just sick and tired of that around here. Eric Schuler, everybody, check him out. ericscottschuler.blogspot.com, the daily facepalm. See y'all tomorrow. Thanks again, man.
Thanks, Scott.